and welcome to Manga Explaining, the show where we recommend great manga to folks who haven't read much manga before. Hosted by Deb Oki, David Brothers, Chip Zdarsky, and myself, Christopher Woodrell Butcher. Follow along with our show notes and reading list at mangasplaining.com, and check out our newsletter and publishing endeavor at mangasplainingextra.com. Hi, I'm Christopher, and this week we are reading, we're going back to the well for another book by Kyoko Okazaki. It's called River's Edge, and it was released pretty recently. It was released in June by Vertical, or Kodansha, but it was originally written in 1993-1994, so it's up there with some of the older work that we've covered. Longtime listeners will know that we covered Kyoko Okazaki's Helter Skelter all the way back on episode number 4 of Manga Explaining. So it's been a long time, and many of you have joined us since then. Thank you. Maybe you want to go check out that episode as well, because I think we might be referring to the continuity of Okazaki Sensei's output in this book. Speaking of this book, let's start at the very beginning with the back cover copy. At the edge of a city not far from the sea, a field of goldenrod sways in the breeze, its veil of amber flowers obscuring secrets underneath. Old bones and forgotten memories rest in silence, waiting for someone to dig them up. This is where the lives of 6 young men and women intertwine in ways both tragic and extraordinary. Decaying secrets are revealed as they forge friendships from pain, find betrayal in pleasure, and stare into the face of death itself, in a field of gold by a stagnant river under the smoke-filled skies. Okay. That is accurate. Sure. I was just listening to a previous episode, and it was like, I don't know if that was an accurate, description of a book we read, but that's all there. That's all there in the book. So yes, this is River's Edge by Kyoko Okazaki. The editor on this was Ajani Oloye, translated by Alexa Frank, and the production was Raisa Cho, Pei Anip, and Lorena Mappa, proofreading by Mika Q. Allen. This is a heavy one, as Kyoko Okazaki's books released into English all are. And before I give all of the background on the book that I have dug up on the internet before starting this podcast, I kind of just want to get everyone's impressions, see how they felt about River's Edge. Deb, I want to start with you this week. This is kind of a heavy book. What did you think of River's Edge?
I actually liked it a lot more than Helter Skelter, honestly. Yeah.
Really?
Just kind of like the way she lets the story unfold with the kids. And then the moment.
Yeah.
Pure horror, like, oh my god, what? Sometimes, like come up in ways that you don't expect, and at moments you don't expect. Yeah. The way that she kind of like has this really interesting mix of, you know, sex and death and betrayal and the pettiness of high schoolers, you know, overlaid over the part, you know, where Yamada, the gay boy, that what he deals with, what the main character girl. Like her boyfriend being mean to him and other girl who Kana, who basically puts out for him, like these intertwined things. And then Yamada's girlfriend and the model who binges and purges. It's like really interesting characters and how they all kind of come together. And, you know, they're not pals.
No,
but
no,
they definitely, their actions and reactions to each other definitely propel the story forward in an interesting way.
I didn't mention that this is technically a shoujo manga that ran in a fashion magazine in 1993-1994 aimed at teen girls. So it wasn't even in a...
Wow.
technically wasn't even in a shoujo magazine. It's sort of like Paradise Kiss in that way, where it's just sort of existed outside of... Ran at a magazine called Cutie, which is now no longer published.
Cutie, but, oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's spirit. It stopped in 2015, I think, but its spirit lives on. David, what did you think of River's Edge?
I am also stunned that this was for teen girls instead of grown women. But it kind of makes sense with like the high school setting. Like,
yeah,
this could easily be a Jose story if they were in college, because everyone is like unrelentingly terrible in their own special ways. But like, I'm pretty sure Kyoko Okazaki was like my introduction to Jose when Vertical was just putting out like Pink and Helter Skelter and stuff. And this is so of a piece with those books that I ended up liking this one quite a bit. It's like some people are good at taking literally everything and like sharpening it to a point, using it as a weapon. And I think this book is full of people who are like that, especially Like, let's go freak out the squares by looking at this dead body. Like, there's some, we'll get into it, I'm sure, later, but one of the worst moments in the book for me was when Kozue was like, hey, Yamada found another dead body, and it's your friend. And it's like, what did you think was...
And your boyfriend killed her.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
So...
That was... And then the chapter ended, and you're just like, oh my god.
Yeah, it's like a Curb Your Enthusiasm ending. It's seriously the worst.
Yeah, it's weird. With a book with so many characters of questionable morals, values, morality. I don't know what.
Yeah.
Morality. Yeah, she felt like the most sociopathic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was interesting.
Hmm. Yeah, I am pro Okazaki.
Keep it going, Chip. What did you think?
Oh, I mean, I quite liked it. At first, I the first 20 pages or whatever, I'm like, oh, I don't know if I'm going to dig this at all. Because it was kind of set up as like, oh, okay, this gay kid is being bullied. And like, it felt like it could have been a revenge story. Like, the gay kid like comes back and like murders the bully or whatever. And I was like, yeah, I can be along with that, but it's not that interesting to me. But then I was like, well, there's so many other characters here that I'm trying to keep track of. Like, what's their story going to be? And then once you realize it's a real ensemble, mm-hmm. and the way it builds, like, I don't think, out of all the books we read, I don't think I was that stressed towards the end. Like, everything collided. Like, it was mm-hmm. really well done in terms of, like, kind of bringing the whole situation for all the characters to a boil and not quite knowing how this is going to turn out. Super well done. Mildly uncomfortable. Like, we're all going to prison for reading this.
In, like, the best possible way, but yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So I quite liked that. I think I liked it more than Helter Skelter. Helter Skelter is probably, like, the more mature work, but, like, this was, like, very entertaining.
So it's amazing to hear that you guys all vibe with this one, because it was 1993, 1994. It was in a fashion magazine, sort of like Helter Skelter was, sort of like Paradise Kiss. And it was a pretty revolutionary piece of writing in 1993. River's Edge ended up really influencing. This was the first work of its kind. Of, you know, like, teens really looking into their lives, you know, terrible things are happening and we're failing a generation of kids. And it ended up affecting a lot of work that came afterwards. When I first started looking at River's Edge for a project that did not come to fruition, the first book I found when I went to go buy it was a book that was a tribute to River's Edge. And it was great writers and illustrators and comics makers. And it was a 400-page book of, like, writing and essays and original fiction that were all inspired by River's Edge, with like quotes from famous Japanese writers and artists that had been like, this is the book that changed everything for me. And this was Okazaki Sensei's sort of major work right before, I think, the next year she started Helter Skelter. She's working on a number of serializations pretty much simultaneously, but she really seems to have honed her skills into like a razor's edge rather than a river's edge with this book. And it is phenomenal. I kind of hoped that the gay character would come back and kill them all at the end, but that is not the story that it ended up being. And I actually feel a little bit bad about this, but while I was reading it, I was like, man, Riverdale wishes that they were half as tight as plotting as this, where yeah. It is a story about teens who are like maybe doing a lot of stuff. Like, it's always believable the whole way through. Everyone is damaged enough in a believable way, as opposed to Riverdale, where you're never like, it's a little bit too Twin Peaksy at times for its own good. And all of the characters are just moved to like chess pieces on the board to exactly where they need to be for the ending to hit in the way that it does and why that it does. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's really, really talking about a lot of stuff that has worked its way into media now, but I can see how this would have been really revolutionary in 93 and 94. And I wasn't sure if you'd be like, oh, well, we've kind of seen all of these bits before when I was going to ask you guys about it here for the podcast, but I'm so happy to just think that it still really hit you. Like, it still really affected you. And it's a story from literally 30 years ago.
It's one thing I thought about while reading this was like the teen aspect and how adult it is. Mm-hmm. Because this is going to sound so dumb. I was a Nancy Drew kid. This is not the dumb part. But like, I love those books. They're great mystery novels, and they recently made a like a modern version, I think 2019, 2020, something like that. And like, it opens with a sex scene, and I'm like, this is trying to do a thing, but it's not doing it well, like pushing forward into maturity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a shortcut for it, you know?
Yeah. It's like, oh, you know, she has sex and maybe, I don't know, smokes or whatever it was in the series. It wasn't a very good TV show in the end. But this book, like, comes out of the gate with a bunch of wild stuff, and it fits a lot better, I think, because of the perspective that Okazaki has, where it's less like, look how cool and sexy this is, and more, these kids are really in for it this year. Like, there's nothing good on the horizon.
Yeah.
Even the bit with the old man, I think it's in chapter 2, where he's calling for his dog. And it's just kind of a non sequitur for like 2 or 3 chapters until you find out there's a dead body in the field.
That the dog has been chewing on.
Like, I didn't watch Riverdale, but everything I've heard about it, like, I get the comparison you're making. And it's funny that, like, my version of that is for Nancy Drew instead of Riverdale.
That's maybe the last thing I started watching, and then it was just, it was too much. Riverdale turned me off of TV. But I will say, I think You Should Leave got me back. Been rewatching that. I'm so sad there's only 3 seasons that I got to go find his other sketch comedy stuff. I think he's got like a one shot and then like a whole troupe he was in that I saw some stuff. Anyway, Tim Robinson hole on YouTube. It's pretty good. I want to be unfair for a second, because I want to talk about, everyone sort of mentioned how this was either uncomfortable or prison inducing, because this is like a teen book that deals with really heavy stuff. And honestly, working in the sort of YA area of library stuff for the last couple of years, this is not completely out of the ordinary. Going back to like something like S.E. Hinton's The Outsiders or something like that, like, there have always been books at the older end of this, of the teen scale, that we're dealing with like real shit. And I think that this is probably that for Japan in the 90s, and that there are, those books still exist today, although they definitely would have had Okazaki Sensei's sort of influence into them. But I want to directly compare it to a book we recently read called Not All Girls Are Stupid, which is another sort of really brash shoujo-ish, jose-ish, like, story about, specifically centered on women dealing with sexuality and what it's like to be a young woman in your late 20s and dealing with, you know, kind of crappy guys and trying to have some sense of self and of setting boundaries and things like that. And that book, was maybe aimed for the same audience. And how do you, but was definitely more upfront about its sexuality. And it was published in 96, 97. And it's definitely a work that was created post this book. So I was just wondering if you guys had any thoughts on how these two titles interacted for you, what they're trying to say, what they're trying to put on the page.
I think the Not All Girls Are Stupid version of River's Edge would be like 8 pages long. Like, she would wrap it up so fast, you know? But even more inconclusive at the end.
Mm-hmm.
No, I didn't think about that comparison, but that's pretty cool. It's definitely a good companion, I think.
Did one come before the other?
Yeah, this was first.
This was first, yeah.
This was in 93, and then Not All Girls Are Stupid is 96, 97.
Yeah, it feels very, the way that she's, it's very unvarnished, you know, it's not romanticized about, you know, like how, like the Gekika movement, right, kind of went from like this idealized adventures of like, say, Flash Gordon type of thing, right? Or,
well, we all know, but Chip doesn't know yet. We haven't let him read any Gekiga, but that'll be next season. We're all gonna get some Tatsumi in there. It'll be good.
Yeah.
But it got more, you know, gritty and more real about everyday, what it's like to live in an everyday, not glamorous, not rich people, not fantasy world, you know, sunshines and sparkles, Japan. And this is very no sunshine and sparkles, teenagers.
Yeah.
You know, in their meanness, in their jealousies, in their obsessions, in their way that they feel like their relationships are their be all and end all. You know, like how Tajima is, where she's really like, Yamada's my boyfriend, and she's going to do all the things that she's read in magazines, presumably, about what she should do as a girlfriend, right? Knit him a sweater. You know, do this with him, hold hands, do all these things. And Yamada is not holding up his end of the deal.
No, he's not. No.
But she refuses to believe, and she believes, like, I think some kids do at some point, you know, particularly achievers. If I only try hard, things will work out, you know?
Some adults, too.
Some of us don't grow out of that. There's nothing to be done.
Yeah.
God, they're all such extreme versions of characters in this. Like, Tajima is just, like, so far into that, like, clueless kind of, like, I need this person to be, you know, my boyfriend. Like, yeah, it actually kind of vibes with Chris's Riverdale analogy. Like,
yeah,
extreme characters that don't necessarily exist in real life, or if they do, you'd find one of them, but you wouldn't find all of these characters all coexisting at the same time, the same place.
Because this is what happens. Someone's house gets burned down.
Yeah, exactly. Someone's house gets burned down and, you know, their sister gets... Yeah, anyway.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. Jesus.
Should we just say this is full of spoilers? Like, there's...
Yeah, this is a spoiler heavy episode. We've already kind of... But it's...
Classic.
But even with the plot being spoiled a little bit, I honestly feel like this is more of a... We can tell you what happens, but until you experience it happening on the page, you're not going to get, you know what I mean? That's when the knives really come out.
Yeah.
Even if you know what's going to happen, the way it actually happens is probably much worse than you're imagining. And like that gap between what you're fearing and like what's coming is the terror part. But that's, I think, why I read Kyoko Okazaki in a way. Because if this were a straight up romance, then it would be less fun, less interesting. But because everyone in this is a walking disaster and for some reason intensely monogamous, that all of this stuff goes down.
We get insight. We get, there's six main characters, as the book, back of the book said. And then there's maybe another six or seven characters that get names. And then beyond that, everyone's sort of a face in the crowd, you know? And I think back to my own time in high school and how there were probably six people who were the main character, to use a colloquialism, at my school, that were pretty messed up in exactly this way. Like, I don't think, while all of these characters are extreme, I don't think any of them couldn't have actually gone to the same high school as I did. And I do think that it's interesting. Actually, maybe it's closer to Chip's experience, because Chip and I mean, we grew up both outside of Toronto, but in, I think, very different kind of locales. And, you know, there's a river by my school, but it was not stagnant next to a factory. Whereas in my mind, maybe Barrie or Hamilton has more of that going on, like where Andrew, my husband, grew up, where it was just like, just down the road is like a steel smelting plant. And it always smells like garbage, you know, on hot days, kind of a thing. Or where my dad grew up, even downtown by the stockyards. So, I don't. For me, it read as this is all very possible. And the goofiness was also very, there's some really like goofy over the top moments in this, but it also felt like very real as well to me. I was wondering if tonally, did you feel like anything didn't work?
I think it all worked within what was set up. Like, I don't necessarily agree that it felt like possible, but it felt like the world was created in such a way that I bought what was happening in the world. Like a character gets almost murdered in a field to the point where they think she's dead, and then she goes home and gets almost murdered again.
Yeah.
Like but in the context of this story, it's just like, oh yeah, no, that makes sense. Cause like you can, like, all these characters are built that way, and the setting's built that way, and the tensions are built that way. Like, of course the sitter's gonna take a box cutter to you when you come home after almost dying.
She's been waiting. Yeah. She's had that box cutter that whole time. She's just been waiting for her.
She should have taken the milk out of her room. It was so rude.
So rude.
But the
and probably drinking the from side. The carton.
Yeah.
Oh God. Oh, geez. The death penalty right there. So, anyways, I bought it all because, and it, not just in terms of like the writing, but the art as well, kind of creates this like the tone of the place and the characters. So it's easier to buy into the situation.
Mm-hmm. There's, like Chip, I also bought into it a great deal. Even there was one thing that kind of pulled me out of it, but I love the attempt. And I don't have the page number handy, so good luck. But there's a moment where they quote William Gibson.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't think it really works in a comics form necessarily. Like in a movie, it would be perfect. It's like black background, kind of like a quiet, sad voice, like quoting this, you know, novel. But in a comic, it's just kind of like more captions. And it took me a second to realize what they were doing. But like the juxtaposition of what the captions are saying about love and kind of writing this new feeling, writing this new, you know, unfamiliar area versus what the rest of the book says about love, which is that a lot of people will not care that you're a human being. I don't know. It's nice comparison.
Yeah.
And it made me want to read the novel too, Robert Longo.
I haven't read that one either, so.
Yeah.
That's an interesting thing, because the part that stuck out to me and made me actually think of the Not All Girls Are Stupid comparison by Manami Kita was where she's like, here's what it was like for me to have sex. You know, one, it wasn't that big a deal after it happened. Two, sex is inherently ridiculous. Three, and it was like, obviously, it was in her voice. It was in, and it was a voiceover for things that were sort of happening in the panels on the page. But also it felt instructional in the same way that some of Not All Girls Are Stupid did, because obviously these are adult women who are writing these stories pulled from their own lives, the lives of their friends probably, and handing them down to the next generation of girls and saying, this is what I've already been through.
Yeah.
Watch out. And I thought that worked really well, where she was really, you know, obviously the writers are always putting words in the characters' mouths, but this was pretty direct. This moment. Yeah.
Yeah. That felt very real, very genuine. Like, author talking straight to the reader. Yeah. It did feel instructional the same way. The idea that you need to dig a grave deeper than you think.
Yeah.
It's real. Like, there's a lot of instruction in here.
Yeah. The page Christopher is talking about also has an illustration that says safe sex and has...
I love that.
Yeah, I thought that was, one of the pages that I screenshot.
And yeah, that was great.
It's funny looking at it now because it's almost like a Sex Criminals XXX cover. Just like, here's your instruction manual.
yeah, I can see that.
But much, much meaner. Yeah. But the matter of factness of it was something I really liked too. I'm glad that like other people like that, because it's kind of... Some things are mysteries until you're grown, or until you actually experience it. Like, think of all the wild stuff your friends told you about, like, body parts when you were a kid that they clearly just made up, you know?
Yeah.
And then you grow up and it's like, oh, it's not like that at all. And I think this book is a lot of, like, it's not like that at all, but also please be careful. Mm. Like, safe sex came up two or three times. They mentioned that Ken Onzaki, the main character's boyfriend, isn't having safe sex with someone else. So she has, like, a pregnancy scare. I think that was maybe the most realistic high school drama part of it.
No, the most realistic part was that, but it was why. He's like, because she's accusing him. She's like, I'm late. You never were safe with me, but you're always safe with your girlfriend. And you just don't respect me. You would just get me high and then fuck me. And like, it wasn't even a big deal. And that was real. Like, that was.
Yeah.
That's the thing I pulled out of this, is that there's so much real shit in here. And it's like, you were fucking me, but you didn't respect me at all. And you, like, respect your girlfriend, despite the fact that you, like, hit her and you're kind of a piece of shit. Like, that was, like, the next level for me. Because, absolutely, yes, what you're saying, but, like, there's other weight to it.
Yeah.
But that was definitely that attitude. I mean, everyone gets really down on, you know, the woke feminism that's around now.
Not everyone,
but, you know,
but yeah.
Tell me about it.
But, you know, it's like, you got to admit that, like, when you receive this behavior, right, where the boy treats one girl as his whore and one girl as his pseudo wife.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right? Absolutely.
The virgin whore thing is like, you can see that as being reprehensible and not like, oh, yeah, that's what guys do. Mm-hmm. You know,
or both.
Mm-hmm. A little bit of both. Yeah.
Yeah,
like it is reprehensible, but it was so like, of course, that's exactly, he's got problems with his family. He doesn't have a strong dad figure. His mom's sick, so he needs a new mom, and he's going to make his girlfriend his mom. Like, it was very like, dun, 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 dun. we've worked our way down that path.
Yeah, check boxes.
Yeah.
And then she feels bad because he put all that shit on her, and she was like, oh, I wasn't there for him when he really needed me, so I guess I'll have sex with him again. Like, I felt a little ill, actually. Yeah. I had to put the book down at that one.
Yeah.
I actually loved that twist.
Yeah.
Development something.
Yeah.
Because I like that she's becoming aware of, like, oh, other people have interiority as well. But she doesn't have the tools to know what to do about it. So it's like, oh, well, I guess it's sex. Because she even says, I think, in the dialogue after that moment, or the inner thoughts, she's like, we didn't have to have sex. We could have talked about it if I knew what to say or something. Like
Yeah, absolutely.
I thought that was really astute. Like, definitely like a grown woman writing with the benefit of age and wisdom. Because so much of, like, sometimes you try something and it's not the right thing, but it's the only thing you know how to try.
Yeah, it's funny. It's like sex was the shortcut to let you know it's a mature tale, and sex is also the shortcut to, like, conversation.
Basically, everything looks like a nail.
Yeah.
And all they have are hammers.
Yeah.
I mean, there's aspects of, like, Yamada and Yoshikawa, the model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In that, one thing that occurs to me is, like, Yamada, you know, being gay, has a life outside of school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's met and hung out with people who aren't in school, or maybe older, who live different lives than his parents did, or, you know, live a normal, outside of that, right? And then the model, obviously, lives a model's life, right? Where they're dealing with very, you know, artistic people, like, people artists, in the entertainment industry, whatever. Mm-hmm. But, like, you have this, compared to the other, they kind of have this little bit of disdain for the other.
Yeah, they're checked out. They're completely checked out of, and, like, a little bit sociopathic as well. They're like, look, a dead body, because they've, it's.
In the kind of way goth kids used to be, like, oh, dead bodies are cool, or like, oh, I'm so above it all because I've seen death.
Yeah, like, there's a girl who I was friends with who I like, there's no shade, but she used to full on carry a vial of mercury on a necklace around her neck, who was a goth, and to quote Sylvia Plath at people, and just wait to die. Like, I'm waiting to die, and I'm just sent here every day, and every day I look at my mercury, and you're like, okay, but at 16 you're like, oh yeah, no, she's cool. She's cool, cool girl.
Very cool.
And at the time you think that, like, the people like that think, like, I'm doing this to make me above it all, right?
Mm-hmm.
To emphasize that I'm not like you little kids, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Even in your mind. But in the end, like, you know, you're reading this and you go, like, oh, that's what high school kids think is being cool and above it all looks like. It
feels like. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're still, and they can't see that they're still fucking up. Pardon my friend.
Yeah.
But they just, they can't see it. They don't. And they also, like, we get hints of it. It's like, oh, I read in a magazine, actually, that, like, I read in a magazine that the model girl's mom is like an awful stage mother who's like abusive. And it's like, first off, that's terrible. And now we have a little bit of backstory on, like, why the model girl has issues with food and weight and, like, her parents and not being really checked into school. But also, can you imagine going to school and people are reading about your home life, your friends or your classmates are reading about your home life in magazines? And then you've still got to be in school with them. Like, just that level of it, it really shows that, yeah, this person's in a really shitty position and they're really dealing with themselves and other people in a shitty way. But also the things that have been done to them at 16 or whatever they are also awful, like, so awful. It's, it's pretty good at that, at making you feel bad for everybody. Despite, like,
there are
what they
flashes
do.
Of empathy, not empathy, that's the other direction. There are flashes where they make you, like, empathize or relate to the characters.
Oh, absolutely.
And even the characters have those moments. Like, Haruna realizes, like, wait, Kozue is a model and popular and cool, and she was just saying how all those people are fakers and liars. Maybe she's just good enough to be that. Yeah. Like, there's so much of characters kind of, like, almost getting to the point, you know?
Yeah.
Where from an adult perspective, you can easily see the point. Like, it's like an 11th grade lesson. But, you know, they're not quite there yet.
Mm. Yeah.
Do you, Christopher, do you remember much of Blue Spring, the Taiyo Matsumoto short story collection?
Why, I'm glad you asked. I've actually got that open on the other screen.
Then I will cede my segue.
Was that a setup?
It actually, I wish. I thought about really Blue Spring a lot.
Yeah,
it came to mind because it feels like the boys manga version of this a little bit, of a bunch of, like, kind of messed up, not quite... they don't have it figured out yet. Anyway, Christopher, what was your Blue Spring pitch? What did you have for us?
Yeah. So Blue Spring was one of Matsumoto's first works. Taiyo Matsumoto, who we covered here on the podcast, we read Ping Pong and Tekken on Kinkreet. This is one of his first works, and I was a big booster for it. Kelly Sue DeConnick actually, I think, rewrote this one.
Oh, wow.
When they were doing translation and then adaptation more, Kelly Sue rewrote this one, and it was an early Viz pulp release. But it is set in a school that is pretty close to the school we get here in River's Edge, a like low-end, low-achieving kind of a school. And the it's a series of short stories that are seemingly unconnected, but they're just about kids at this school. But what's really happened is the last sort of chance, the last glimmer of hope of the school has died because the school baseball team loses their chance to go on to Koshin, basically onto like the big high school baseball thing. So everyone's just waiting for the year to end and like the school might actually be like shut down kind of a thing, but that's all in the background. Instead, it's these stories about these kids who have never had anything and now they've lost like even the last little bit of hope. So there's one story that's called Clap Your Hands, where the kids are like, all right, they go up to the school roof and they hold on to the bars on the edge of the roof and they start to fall backwards and they see how many times they can clap their hands before they grab the bar before they fall off of the roof while they're falling.
Yeah.
And whoever claps their hands the most is the coolest kid in school.
Oh yeah.
Until one particularly damaged person goes for the record and dies, and it's like story ends. It's just brutal. It's like a brutal, brutal short story. And no one seems to care, right? Like there's nothing, because no one, like, he didn't have anything going on anyway, or he didn't feel like he had anything on going anyway. The adults that are at the school are all they're all terrible. Like it's just, yeah. So it very much has a similar vibe, I think, to River's Edge. So if you're one of the very few people who read Blue Spring when it came out, it's been out of print for a while. River's Edge is for you, I absolutely think. But it is,
yeah.
It does feel like boys' comics had permission to have delinquents and to have like real life and to have really sort of screwed up characters, and girls' comics didn't, to me and anything else I've read, feel like they had permission until Okazaki started making work that was a little bit more real.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was interesting when Deb was adding to the show notes for Not All Girls Are Stupid, you specifically mentioned like the Riot Girl phenomenon, where like girls, you know, especially in the 90s, girls and women were like, actually, no, we're tough and we're hard and fuck you. And we're going to like be honest about everything. And I think that there's a little bit of that there where it's just like there is a social movement coming up and Okazaki sees it and is like, I'm going to take my shot. I'm going to try and say some real things, because the boys can always, you know, do that.
Mm-hmm.
Although yeah. Blue Spring is almost completely sexless. It's all about dudes.
I was going to say, like,
vocational high school. I talked to Matsumoto about that. I don't know if anyone cares about this, but I talked to Matsumoto about that. And he's like, yeah, I just didn't know how to draw women. So I just didn't put women in any of my early books. And he also didn't That's really so know funny. A lot about sex, actually. So he didn't put sex in any of his early books either. Oh. Yeah.
All right.
It was just something he wasn't comfortable
draw what you know.
taking on as a creator. And you don't really see that until, I think, one of the ones we didn't get translated, Bamboo Samurai, has some great, great, great female characters in it. And then it sort of changes from there. Sunny has a couple of female characters that are good. And yeah, anyway.
But I respect that he knew that about himself, you know, that some people will try it anyway and do a poor job of it.
I know that because I think Chip also mentioned that in our first Matsumoto episode. Like how the women.
Why are there no ladies in this?
Yeah, there right. we go. There we go.
Right, yeah. right.
But I was thinking about it, and the boys comics did have a certain amount of freedom, but I think that in terms of sexuality, not necessarily, maybe.
I think the sex roles in boys comics are awful. Like,
and I'd say no names. Still awful, to be honest.
Yeah. I don't want to.
I can do it without naming names.
Yeah, I'm upset. No, I'll say just flat out, I think.
Yeah.
Some of the nicest looking and most compelling comics are the books of Oba and Obata. So like the Death Note and Bakuman. And they are some of the worst treatments of female characters in like the history of shonen. Like these are contemporary stories that treat women appallingly badly and girls appallingly badly. And it's like, you can kind of write it off that the characters are like self-involved, like psychos, like the two boy characters, but like in either of the books, but like, women are like barely set dressing and don't get good endings, right? Like Risa and Death Note has just been like, okay, I'm done with you. And she's like sent off, I guess, maybe to die off panel. Like it was just awful. And then Bakuman, the way it treats female artists in shoujo manga is no better. And it's such a bummer because these are such good books in so many other ways. But like shonen manga, I think is pretty bad at it, and seinen slightly less so, because seinen can just retreat into a world where everyone's a dude and they just don't have to address, they don't have to address women, so they don't get it wrong. They just are creating a problem due to the absence of it, which is like different than being actively bad, I guess. So, but yeah, like the most, the two most disappointing works I've read in that regard are Bakuman and Death Note, because they pretend to maybe be something else, and that gets me. Like, just be real. Be like, I don't know about women, so they're not my story. Like, fine, learn about women someday, or learn to write them anyway. Or like, oh, I'm just like I'm an asshole, and I have bad opinions about women. Great, be upfront about that. Don't get me hooked on your story and then slowly reveal that over 18 volumes, please. All right, then rant over.
But I want to point out something too.
Yeah, yeah.
The Death Note live action that came out a couple of years ago that was produced by Masioka was adapted. They made the Risa character, they adapted her because they too thought she was too much of a doormat, right? And so they gave her like a backstory, and they gave her much more spunk and much more this or that. It completely had to change the entire story and how it ended. Like, because, and then it was like this pivot point where the logical end of how the story went didn't work anymore. So they had to change it. It went off the freeway and went on a completely different tangent and became a completely different ending because they made the decision to make the female character not so horrible, not so stupid.
Not so nothing. Yeah.
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 I think about that. It's like, wow, that was a decision in the adaptation. And I don't know if that was the right decision, but I know they had to make it.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Blue Spring comparison came to mind because, and also like speaking more generally about like kind of what girls' comics and boys' comics are focusing on, I feel like the gun in Blue Spring is like sex in this, where they both represent this kind of unknowable must-have thing that will eventually like result in somebody's destruction.
Yeah.
So I think that's why they feel like a great also coming out in the same year, I feel like it's really remarkable. Like they feel like a great compliment to each other.
There's something in the air for sure, I think, with those books. Yeah, Chip, I know it's not an official Among Explaining pick, but Blue Spring, your friend wrote it. It's technically like reading a friend book. It's quite good.
And available on Kindle as well. I had to pick one up a while back because I was like, you know, I can't really find it in stores anymore. That's worth having.
If you think I'm taking on extra manga to read on top of this.
For fun.
For fun.
Oh, no. Yeah. Have we turned manga into something unfun?
No. This is more of a schedule thing than a fun thing.
Okay.
Well, can I share next a month's fun
pick
thing?
Is four consecutive books. So yeah, no, I'm just kidding. Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah.
On page 156 of River's Edge there's like three panels that made me laugh, and none of it has to do with the dialogue. It's all the background drawings. And panel one, there's a Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey poster. Panel two is like a Clockwork Orange dude, like caricature.
Wait, what page again?
156.
Yeah.
And then at the bottom of the next to last panel, there's a poster for a porno. It's called Pingu XXX Sex Animal Pingu.
You're a master finding these little things. It's crazy.
The nice thing about digital comics is when you see lettering, you can kind of zoom in a little bit.
Just get in there. Yeah.
And you know, Chip is an expert at this kind of thing. So I respect background gags, and these are good background gags.
Solid. Very solid.
I love the background gags in this, and there's lots of notes incorporated in like in the gutters here rather than putting them at the end, which I think really helps. Little things like there's a magazine on the floor of Haruna's room, and it's the magazine that she would also make comics for sometimes to show that like she's a teen girl, like you're a teen girl because you read the same magazines. Actually, this could be you. Like, pay attention. Such a good moment. And then at the bottom, it's like, this is a magazine that Koki Okazaki would have work in. And you're like, there you go.
That one's for the adults.
Yeah.
I like the one where they make a reference to a TV show. And then like the note says, this usually aired at this time of night.
Yeah.
And so it's like, oh, so they're not just explaining that it's referring to a TV show. They're explaining why narratively what it's saying, talking about this TV show tells a Japanese reader.
Yeah.
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 Which I thought was, that's smart. And that's not something that every translator does, mm-hmm. but I think that's so important.
Yeah, it was kind of overwhelming at first. Really? Yeah. It took me a little bit to like get the pacing of reading the notes and also the comic.
Yeah. Yeah, there are a lot of margin notes.
I loved them. I wish more books had just so many margin notes, actually. Because it feels like, maybe I think I read comics weird sometimes. Because I think about how I'm taking in all of the information that the panel has to give me. And mm-hmm. then if there's margin notes, it's like, oh, good, more information. And I don't think that's how most people read comics, but I kind of love them for
pretty normal.
What they add.
It was more about the amount for me.
Well, there's an intense one on 92, right? Where it says, does everybody want 100 million yen? And it says, in the vein of Transamerica Ultra Quiz, a game show that ran from 1977 to 1992, blah, 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 blah. Captains contestants would travel across America participating in a series of grueling physical and intellectual challenges. Oh my goodness, it's like four lines.
And very little. I'm reading print, so I didn't love how little it was because I'm getting old, but
I had to take my glasses off to read it.
Maybe I will go get the digital so I can get all the good background gags. Like
you know who does good margin notes is Hellboy, actually.
Oh,
really? Whenever something comes up, like a reference to a work of art or something, there'll be like a little margin note that says, you know, so-and-so drew this in this era or died mysteriously. Mm. It's very rare, but it always helps build the mood. Like it's part of what Mignola is doing. Well, I think these notes were added after, maybe. And that's kind of like quite a different feel.
Yeah, yeah. These are by the translator.
But she was telling a lot of story, like through pop culture references, which I always like. It's very fun.
I find them weird and I refuse to read them.
But I like them when Ryan North does them. Do you like them when Ryan North does them? He has margin notes.
He has alt text at the bottom, like an extra joke at the bottom.
Mm, he's been getting into captions too. Well, maybe not for Fantastic Four, but yeah.
Yeah, like for me, it's like if I was reading a novel and all of a sudden, like in the middle of the novel, there was like a paragraph like, oh, this means this because of this and this and this. I'd be like, what? Like, I don't know it.
No, I've read books like that. Yeah.
No, you get like footnotes in like mm-hmm. in like nonfiction, but you don't. I mean, not the books I read. I read really smart, intelligent adult books.
Pulitzer Press winning. I got to rejoin book club.
In your light novels. In your light novels, maybe they do that.
Yeah, there's like a 3-page aside to explain.
Actually, they legit do that in light novels.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, this is obviously a different thing because it's as a result of the translation. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the key is to be a smart writer and give the reader the information in a way that doesn't break the narrative.
Yeah.
Like if it's something integral to it, if it's not integral to it, if it's something additional that would help you if you knew about like a Russian invasion of 1918 or whatever, then you just don't mention it. Like you just mm-hmm. you keep going. But if the story needs that, then you'd be like, oh, the Russian invasion of whatever, which, you know, meant this and this and this.
Mm-hmm.
As mm-hmm. part of the narrative.
Yeah, I get what you mean. I think that there is a fine line. And I think it's valid that you guys were like, ugh, that's a bit much. But I like Deb's point, too, that it's like, we're trying to set time of day. We're trying to set mood. We're trying to be like, I got home in time to watch morning cartoons without localizing it and being like, oh, cartoons had started, or like, you know what I mean? It was instead, mm-hmm. oh, such and such the show that every 16-year-old girl reading this manga in 1993 would instantly know what that was and why it was important, what time of day it was, and without localizing it and just glossing it instead. I don't know. I find it kind of feel like I learned a little bit in addition to being horrified by the story.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because these are things I wouldn't know. Like these mm-hmm. kind of deep cultural touchstones, particularly from that time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, obviously, you know, I keep up with some of this stuff, but there's a lot I don't know. And the fact that, like I said, that as Chris was saying, that he made the translator and the editor made the effort to make it give you the same impression.
Yeah.
That you would get as a Japanese reader, even though it meant you doing a little extra work, I think was important.
There was one translation note that was almost admitting defeat. Like,
oh yeah, which one?
There was a line like, no sweat till you sweat or something like that. I'll have to go through the book again to find it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But I know it has like four asterisks next to it. And they're like, it's a reference to this magazine that this guy used to draw in, that this model kit person who works for this paint company used to comment. And it's like, first, I recognize the model kit company, Tamiya. They still make, you know, interesting stuff. And it's like this whole subculture that they're referring to in one line of dialogue that is impossible to get across in localization.
Yeah.
You need like the 8-point font to get it done.
That's awesome. And just committing at a certain point to be like, nothing goes in the back of the book. We're putting everything on the page where it happened.
Yeah.
Editorially, that's bold. But I actually, this is like an aside, but sometimes in the background, I'll have on vintage television commercials, either ones from my childhood, and not necessarily just kid stuff, but, you know, just stuff that's like, oh, I saw that commercial. Andrew and I actually will make little jokes at each other for it, but we'll put on Japanese ones sometimes too, because it's like a history where we were live and it's from, you know, when we were from exactly the same era. It's just, it's all in Japanese and we didn't really have access to any of that. And every once in a while, I'll see something on one of those commercials. It'd be like, I saw that in a manga. And I'm trying to think of what a good one is.
Glico, the running logo guy. It's like,
Yeah. Or it's there's a lot of stuff like the Maxell guy when he's sitting in the chair blown away by the speakers.
Back,
yeah.
But Japan has like 600 of those that have like worked their way into so many aspects of popular culture that are touchstones that people here just know. Oh, I'm in Tokyo, which is why I say people here. Sorry. And it's like, it's a little bit, it's one of those things that, I really like discovering about manga. And it goes to the whole book. This feels like a missing piece of the narrative of what shoujo and Jose comics are, to me anyway. And, you know, shout out to the folks in the comments on the website who we've been talking about whether or not Jose comics are actually a real category or if it's an invention of the West. It's fascinating. We'll maybe get into it next season, but
yeah, I've got a manga realization for you.
Yeah, shoot.
This is actually from our trip to Tokyo with Nick Tagata in 2019. We were talking about how, like, there's so many things in manga that we like how Otomo draws buildings and, like, landscapes and highways and things, how Toriyama draws these, like, little cute squat cars. And then you go to Japan and you're like, oh, that's just what Tokyo highways look like. Like, oh, these are just the small trucks
that
people use to transport things. And it's people drawing what they see. And I think manga is a great view into another place like that. You know, like you're saying, you know, I've seen this in manga and now it's on real TV as well. Like, this is another connection drawn in your brain. It's one of my favorite aspects of reading books is learning something like that.
Yeah.
Especially when you're young and you don't get a chance to visit those places. So, so many people are visiting Japan through, you know, visiting Japan or visiting France or visiting, you know,
New York City
when I was a teenager. You know? New York City. Yeah, for sure. I didn't get to go to New York until I was in my like late 20s. So yeah, for real.
Yeah. Mid-20s? Right. Same page.
So Chris talking about the Maxell being blown away just reminded me, I was going to mention what a transition between the kid about to blow that old man and then the supermodel gorging on the pizza.
Yeah. Oh, that was
a couple bits like that. Yeah.
Like, wow.
There's some really interesting juxtapositions, right? Like, and I read it the second time this morning. And like, for example, in sometimes there's these little markers, right, in the story. That she uses as, I don't know, I guess little transition points, right? Like, so for example, page 119, the old man is walking Pochi the dog, and Pochi comes back with a bone, and you think nothing of it, right? The first time around you read this. The second time you see Pochi, it's like page 115, and this is after they've buried the body. And the old man tells Pochi, oh, why are you so disappointed? Because Pochi can't find any more bones anymore.
Yep.
Grim.
And then so page 219, you see Pochi and the dog walking again. And then they're just, it's normal. But if you blink, you miss it. But there's these really interesting little ways that she repeats motifs. Like the one at page 12 is when they first, Yamada and Rina walk on the bridge the first time. And then they do it again at 224.
Yeah.
So I think they stylistically, there's some really smart ways that she's, you know, using settings and characters and little, what seems like throwaway moments to, I don't know, just kind of indicate some clever ways that the story has moved on, like the way the narrative.
great mood builder, I think.
Yeah. Did anyone else think at the beginning, the first scene where the dog's looking for, or the guy's looking for the dog, that it was a Yamada who was dead?
Oh.
That's what I thought. That's like, I thought,
yeah,
because he doesn't show up to school after that.
Yeah.
And you're just like, oh shit. Like I assume there was a dead body. Yeah. I don't know, as soon as I see a dog in a field, I just assume a dead body. I don't know if that's just me.
Yeah.
Which was another reason why I was kind of like pleasantly surprised when it didn't turn out to be the kind of story I thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
They was like, okay. All right. Yeah.
And she's looking for Kenanzaki, who was bullying him on like that same page. Yeah. That's really good.
Yeah.
There's definitely some tension there, I think.
I also like to call out her use of screen tone.
Oh yeah, I loved it.
Which we mentioned, like Helter Skelter. Like, I love that aquarium scene.
Yeah, that's really so good.
Nice. Yeah,
it was the factory scene for me. There's a moment where she flashes to like a negative space drawing of like a factory building with smoke in the air.
Yes, that's so good.
Which of course I can't find it now, but it's early in the book when she's talking about how kind of the city is falling on hard times a little bit.
Yeah,
and like it doesn't look like a good drawing of a factory in smoke, but it looks like the perfect drawing of the mood of that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 35.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
It kind of looks kind of like Tsuge, don't you think?
Yeah, it's got a really cool style. The way she rendered the smoke, she does a similar rendering style on a lot of the stairs in the building and like the kind of the grimy walls. Yeah.
I love that because that's actually the first scene in chapter 3. No words. No captions. Yeah. Okay. The city was a blah, blah, blah. It's just factory.
Like she occasionally does stuff where I'm like, oh, if this was a seinen manga, it would be like a lot more like the river's edge metaphor. I think it'd be a lot more like front and center. Someone would say like, you know, I'm standing on the banks of this river facing life and death or something. But it's just like a constant.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about it too, right? Like she just, if that 2-page spread is wordless. Mm-hmm. And then you go to the next page and the first box is a black box that has text, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, she could have made the decision to put that text on that factory page, but she didn't.
Yeah.
I think that was a smart decision.
Yeah.
And it's text all about how kind of, you know, industrialization versus living, I guess, is something that kind of like loops through the book a little bit. Sort of like efficiency and commerce over the value of life. And she says, you know, I wonder what they're making in that factory. We're surrounded by manufactured goods. We have no clue to how they're made.
Mm.
Later, she mentions like if like the meats and things, she wishes they were made in a factory near the town. Like there's definitely some fun symbolism going on, you know, motifs and things like that.
And there's some really, I've heard American movies where teenagers or something have this inner dialogue where they observe the world and they're like, it's kind of screwed up, isn't it? Or
a little Ferris Bueller action.
Yeah, kind of, yeah.
There was one, was it Brick with Joseph Gordon-Levitt that was done like a neo-noir with that kind of dialogue? Yeah.
Yeah.
But I thought the river stuff, I made a couple notes on that and how it sort of made me think that what the book is about is the ways that we care about each other and have to learn how to care about each other. Because everyone has like serious problems. I think that Okazaki does a great job of explaining like how Haruna is stuck in this bad relationship. She's like a little bit trapped by her mom. Her piece of crap boyfriend has, you know, legitimate issues. But none of them know how to relate to each other and to recognize that in each other until maybe not even until the end of the book. And just seeing them bounce around like that. I don't know. It's a wild thing to think about. This is just for teenagers in, you know, some fancy magazine. But as an adult, it's nice to see, you know, I don't know, it feels like confirmation that life can be hard, but if you keep trying, you know, maybe you'll figure it out.
Yeah.
You might make it through.
Yeah. Which is definitely not like the intended, you know, I'm bringing this, you know, as a Western person 30 years later, but I really enjoyed reading this, going through it again.
Mm. Yeah.
That sounds like a pretty final thought. Is it?
Yeah. Well, come back to me. We'll see.
Okay. Let's do final thoughts then, and we will come back to David. Deb, we'll start off with you since we started with you. What were your final thoughts on River's Edge?
I mean, I had heard a bunch about River's Edge from, you know, my friends in Japan who read manga. I think Aki Yanagi was telling me that he thought it's one of his favorite manga. And I've heard a bunch of my manga friends say, yeah, it's one of my favorites. It's really good. So I was really thrilled when Kodansha picked it up. You know, and it's lived up to a lot of
why people like it, you know, because I think it's not the feel good hit of the summer.
No.
And sometimes it's narratively a little hard. Like you were kind of like, wait, what happened here? And you have to go back and read. Mm. Like I had to go back and read a couple times to figure out, wait, how did Kana get burnt?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Why does Haruna have to move? Because there's a fire. Like and that's all really, you don't see this happen, right? You don't see Tajima trying to burn her house. You don't see her getting how she gets turned into like basically a burnt Cheeto under a sheet.
Yeah. Like,
but you have to go back and you have to go read the dialogue between some of the people, even a fisherman, or you have to read some of the captions to figure out
Takahashi. Yeah.
Like, oh, yeah. That's what happened. But I thought I read it and I thought, wait, did I miss something? So, but that's also really interesting, you know, storytelling choices, right? And
yeah,
I like that she challenges the reader to read deeply and closely. Mm-hmm. And, it rewards repeat readings because, like I said, the dog thing I didn't notice until I read again.
Yeah. Same, actually.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to mention, too, is like, and I don't want to go without this, is that this cover art is the best ever, most appropriate, most compelling cover design for this book ever. Like, I put in our little sock channel the original Japanese cover of the release. And it's so different. It's basically the close-up of, like, Yamada on page 35, blown up, you know, this disaffected face of him, right? Where he's saying blah. Whereas, like, this one, the Becky's one, takes page 110, where Haruna's in the field and looking up, crops it very close, and then uses, like, this spot gloss to show the river.
Yeah.
I feel like this moment of wonder and confusion and darkness.
Loneliness.
It's so much more evocative of what this book is really about.
Mm-hmm.
Designed by Becky Cloonan.
Good the job, master. Becky.
Yeah.
Really, really good. Chipper, since David wanted us to come back to him, do you want to have your final thoughts on River's Edge?
It'll be worth the wait.
Yeah, I quite enjoyed it. I'm usually all in for the done-in-ones on this podcast. I thought it was just a really kind of well-crafted story that, yeah, you're really sucked into the world. And like Deb was saying, like, you know, there were points we kind of have to maybe reread or kind of read closer, but it really works, especially towards the end of this, because everything kind of happens quickly and fragmented. And that's how they kind of create that tension.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is, it's this culmination of everything. It's so well done. Yeah, I would definitely recommend this to anyone looking for a bit of a twisted read.
For the real sickos out there.
For the real sickos out there.
I do think, just to address both those points that you guys brought up, it does require a closer read at points and a reread in little certain sections if you're not quite sure what's going on. But I think it rewards you for it. It's not pointlessly confusing. It's like, no, we're going to jumble this up because we need you to go back and really think about what's going on here. And I think that's, again, another like masterful moment in the book. So totally agree with you. I had to read a couple sections more than once just to make sure I got what was going on, especially at the end.
Before I forget, because we talked about all the despicable things that kind of happen in this book, but we did not mention one of them really. So,
oh, we got a worn people. Yeah.
For the readers, there is some poor kittens in this.
There's one. Some cruelty to animals.
Some
kittens that don't make it to the end of the book.
Yeah.
No, they grew up and wandered away. What are you talking about?
Yep.
Oh, that reminds me. Did you see that on Twitter? There was like a girl who asked Steven Spielberg, what happened to the dog swimming in Jaws?
Yeah. it was a comic writer's daughter, Ethan Sachs's daughter, got to interview Steven Spielberg and was like, come on, is that dog survive or what?
Because I cry every time I see that dog. And then he reassured her that the dog swam away and was reunited with its family.
Yeah, sharks and dogs are friends.
Sharks and dogs are friends.
Yeah. But my final thought is brief. The Chip mentioned he was like not sure if he was going to be into it when he first started reading. So I was like, when did I kind of click with the book? And it's actually on page 14 in panel one. It's just after she rescues Yamada from the locker and they're walking back. And she says, I speak for the sake of speaking. And what she says is, what they did to you was awful. And it's like, does she believe it yet? Because everything she goes on to say is like, hey, you know, people like you, you know, a lot of the girls like you. And he's like, it doesn't matter. None of this stuff that you're telling me matters because this is what I'm like. And there's such like a delta between the two of her trying to do a good thing and him trying to be honest with her and neither of them really connecting yet.
But he's saying things to shock her and to push her away almost, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, I hate those giggling girls. I want to shove raw garbage into their mouths.
Yeah.
She's trying to be polite and comforting to him. Mm-hmm. But he's telling her, look, this is the deal. And this is how I really feel. And if you think that's ugly, fuck off and go away.
Yeah. It's interesting how he switches that around later on when he's being asked about, like, you know, what, are you the top or the bottom? Do you put it in or do you take it? And he's like, and then he just turns it around on her.
Yeah. That was such a good scene.
Whoa, that was so good.
It was so good because it's such a flip of this where he's like trying to, you know.
And he kind of again, shocker. Like, what do you talk? Do you ask your straight friend how they have sex?
Yeah.
That was great. Most, but not all of my straight friends do not like me turning that back on them, actually. So, as someone who's had that exact conversation, I don't know, 2 dozen times.
Yeah.
They don't prefer it, which is great. That was,
and I'm the ones that who do prefer it love it.
And we're best friends forever now.
Yeah. Hey, what's up?
What's up, buddy? But yeah, that's, I don't know, that's this book in a nutshell for me. Like, there's, the character work is so strong and the abrasive points are so abrasive that I couldn't help but kind of, you know, fall in.
Yeah.
Or it's going to push you away, like that sequence, that early thing. I actually wasn't sure I was going to dig it after picking it, actually. I was a little worried.
Yeah.
So I was exactly his age, the time that this book takes place, and I was a closeted gay kid who had a bunch of friends who were not my school friends, where I had a completely different life than the life that I had at school. And so I started reading this and seeing him getting bullied, and bullied is such a fake word for the abuse that he suffers.
What's happening here? Yeah.
And yeah, I was like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to process this, actually, because this was not, it was not far enough away. It was not fiction that was far enough away from my life, but it's so good.
Yeah.
I've been trying not to editorialize too much because I just listen to myself editorialize the fuck out of another episode. And it's like, yeah, it's so good that it got me over my really complicated feelings about a lot of the stuff that I saw and a lot of the stuff that I participated in when I was exactly the age of the characters in this book when it came out. So I can't think of any stronger recommendation than that. Like, as someone who lived through a lot of, not all of it, I don't think anyone died, thankfully.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, that's not entirely true, but it was after I left school. Yeah, I think that it's a good book, and I'm glad we picked it, and I'm glad it finally got published in English. It's from 1993 to today. I'm glad we got, and after a long drought after Helter Skelter, I'm glad they went back and we got another Kyoko Okazaki book. I hope it's not the last one, because there's a lot more good stuff out there. So yeah.
I just want to say that this is a great book club read.
Oh.
It rewards repeat reading.
Yeah,
like I flipped to 116 to 117, and there's that scene where, you know, Kanazaki is being really sweet to Haruna, like giving, buying her gifts and being like really, you know, being nice to her. And then it's juxtaposed immediately with how badly he's hurt, like really injured Yamada. It's like, oh, how interesting, you know?
Yeah.
And then like I was looking at a picture of Kyoko Okazaki. Which I posted in our little show notes channel.
Yeah, she's so fashionable.
She looks just like the model.
Yeah, she really does, actually.
Like, so then I think of it that way. I think, oh, every time I see, like, at the ending page where it's like you see Yoshikawa, you know, smoking a cig and looking at the reader or looking towards the reader, I think she's kind of self-inserted herself, huh?
That's interesting. We'll throw it in the show notes.
All right.
It's something else. So yeah, so that was Kyoko Okazaki's River's Edge, which is out in paperback and digital right now from Kodansha. And I discovered while I was researching this episode, they released a brand new live action movie of River's Edge in 2018.
Wow. It's
on Netflix internationally. Netflix picked it up and made it a Netflix original. with English subtitles. So if y'all want to, and honestly, I started watching the first 15 minutes and I was like, this is exactly the same as the book. This is so weird. So yeah, if you want a different take on this story, if you want to be able to pause it and leave the room sort of thing, it's on Netflix, wherever you got Netflix right now.
Oh, maybe that's why it got licensed.
Maybe. Although even that's 5 years ago. So who can say? The manga licensing world is a weird one. I think we all know. All right, let's go to the break and we'll be right back. Thanks. Stay tuned.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And we're back from the break. Thank you so much for joining us right until the end. We're running a little bit long this week, so we're just going to do some quick shout-outs. My shout-out was actually in the episode, and it was Tim Robinson's I Think You Should Leave, which is fantastic. And we're watching it, and it's just, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. But I will say, actually, I was talking to a friend this week, and there's a lot of old movies that are sometimes difficult to find otherwise that just seem to have been completely uploaded to YouTube, which I feel like everybody in the world knew except for me. So my shout out this week is the French New Wave cinema film La Jetée, which is the inspiration for the film 12 Monkeys. It's real good, real good movie. And I had never seen it before. A French science fiction film directed by Chris Marker, associated with the Left Bank artist movement. It is a science fiction time travel movie shot in black and white on like the cheapest possible handheld, and it's perfect and just miserable, just miserable. And I felt like it was a good recommendation for a book that was also pretty tough this week. So La Jetée, check it out.
Archive.org is good for that too. If you need
archive.org is good for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there we go. We got two good links in the show notes this week. That'll be great.
My shout out is for you. Because you just finished I Think You Should Leave, Netflix has a series of kind of one-shots called The Characters, where they give various sketch comedians like an episode to do a bunch of sketches. And that's what Tim Robinson did before this. So there's an episode with just Tim Robinson sketches, but there's also one with Lauren Lapkus.
Oh, I saw the Lauren Lapkus one. Yeah, yeah. She's great.
Yeah, and also Kate Berlant and John Early, who is like one of the funniest people alive. And yeah, very good. Very good. Well, thank you. Check them out.
All right, the characters. David, moving right on my screen. What is your shout out this week?
My shout out is a very short anecdote before the shout out. Yesterday, a friend came over and we played fighting games and like got delivery, and it was delightful. So my shout out is playing fighting games in general. Like the competition is so much fun, like against your friends. Once you set aside losing as being a bad thing, it's just like thrill after thrill after thrill, just a constant adrenaline rush. And then when you win, like, it feels amazing. And there are no stakes, so it's like the best kind of losing, you know, if you're not very good. So yeah, play video games with your friends, especially if it's head-to-head competitive, and don't take it too seriously, but enjoy the highs when they get there.
David's shout-out is basically friendship.
Yeah,
yeah, have a friend if you can.
Yeah.
Wow. Effort, victory! It is friendship, effort, and victory, isn't it?
And you edit Shonen Jump books, eh? Weird.
Not anymore.
This is a shout-out for... Oh, we all age.
Yeah, they Logan's run me.
Ryan North beat me so continuously at competitive Super Mario Brothers that he still, if he's trying to get my goat, will just slip it into conversation because he's so good at Mario. And every once in a while, we'll just be talking and I'll be like making a point. And he'll be making a point. He'll be like, we could settle this over Mario, knowing that he would kick my ass. And it's like, well played, Ryan North.
You know what? I'm having dinner with him tonight, so I'm going to bring that up.
And yeah, please do.
At one point yesterday, we were playing in person and then also online with friends who live far away. And one of our friends was dominating like a 20 win streak. So I was like, hey, other friend who's his roommate, I'll give you $20 over PayPal if you go make it stop right now. And
nice. Oh, that's friendship right there.
The chokehold goes a long way.
Deb, what is your shout out this week?
My shout out is a book that I had on my Amazon wish list for so long that when I finally pressed the button to buy it, I accidentally bought two copies. And that sucks in its own way, but it's an awesome book. And maybe I'll give it to one of y'all, but it's the Hollyu book. It's the catalog from the Victoria and Albert Museum's exhibit on the Korean wave.
Okay.
Like K-pop and K-fashion and fandom and comics and stuff like that. It's totally fascinating.
Cool.
I've spent all my time, marinating myself in Japanese culture. And then when I started reading webtoons and watching K-dramas, I realized how much I don't know about South Korean culture and history and just anything. So yeah. I've been kind of just diving into this. And this exhibit was at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London last year. And I was so tempted to just fly there just to see it because I saw the Bowie show there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Nothing like it, right? Nothing like seeing it in an original museum. But no money, no time. Now that I have the book, I deeply regret it because it looks so good. Hmm. So I hope it comes as the show travels to, like the Bowie show did. It would be awesome in LA where there's a huge Koreatown. So I'm hoping.
Yeah, I like it. It's sort of like Cool Britannia for South Korea, I guess.
Oh, it's so amazing.
Hollyu. Okay, yeah, we'll put that in the show notes. That yeah, it looks cool. Yeah, so that's an episode of Mogusplaining, right, guys? We're good. we can all go to sleep.
We did it,
or start our days, as it were. I guess.
Yeah, it's time for my morning nap, actually.
Yeah, perfect. I will do the same. All right. Well, for all of us, that has been an episode of Mogusplaining. We will see you again next week with I don't know what it is, but it'll be in the outros. Take care.
This has been Mogusplaining, episode number 109, River's Edge by Kyoko Okazaki. Thanks for listening. For our next episode, we'll be discussing the manga The Yakuza's Bias by Teki Yatsuda. Want to pick up a copy? Consider supporting your local comic book and manga specialty shop, and you can find one near you at comicshoplocator.com, or check out your local library for print and digital lending options. You can also follow along with our complete reading list and show notes at mogusplaining.com, and check out our newsletter and digital publishing endeavor at mogusplainingextra.com. Thanks to DADS for their musical accompaniment this episode.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.